If you have a Bible this morning, if you would turn to John chapter 2, we're going to begin at verse 1 and read the first 11 verses, and that's where we're going to start this morning. So, this is what John says. He says, on the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, they have no more wine. Dear woman, why do you involve me? Jesus replied. My time has not yet come. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not recognize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now. This was the first miraculous signs Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. Thus he revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. We need to touch on a couple of issues before we get on to what we want to look at this morning. The first of those has to do with into running out of wine. Now, to you and me, that might seem like a non-issue. You just call someone and have some more delivered. But in Jesus' day, this was really a serious issue. You see, the groom's parents and the groom would have been saving wine or money to buy wine as much as they could scrape up and set aside for a considerable amount of time. And they might also have turned to their relatives and said, hey, can you kick in some wine as well? And so when they ran out of wine, they had truthfully collected every ounce of wine they could. And so there was no more wine for them to acquire. Now, since they were partway through the wedding feast, we don't understand this. Partway through the wedding feast. So they were halfway through dinner. Everybody can go home. That's not the case. A wedding feast typically lasted for most of a week. Sometimes a little less. Sometimes they spilled over into a second week. But it was really a communal event. In a day and age where people worked every day of the week, and the Jews had to fight hard just to keep the Sabbath, to take time for a wedding was something kind of like a vacation for the whole community. And so the groom and his family would provide for this feast that would last for several days, and to run out of wine was a significant event. History tells us that there was even a possibility that the groom and his family, having run out of wine, could have been sued by the bride and her parents for failure to provide. Now, I'm no great expert, but I can tell you that's probably not a great way to start out a marriage, having the bride's family sue the groom's family. So you see, it's a lot more involved than running out of something at a wedding today might be. Second, John is not talking about things that people might want to use this passage for today. John is not trying to to either support or speak against weddings and marriages, though elsewhere he does speak to the priority at least of marriage, and probably the wedding as well. Neither can we use this passage to speak for or against drinking alcohol. Though Jesus does create wine, but also we can't look at this like some of the more conservative members of our brotherhood and other circles who tried to claim that Jesus was simply making grape juice. This very much, you read what John writes, this was very much wine, and not just the cheap stuff, not just the stuff I remembered some of the guys on my secular college campus drinking that was like $1.50 a bottle. This was the good stuff that cost hundreds of dollars a bottle. And again, we could look elsewhere and we could see that Jesus speaks positively in the New Testament and Old Testament speak positively of the non-drunken use of alcohol. It's just not here. Finally, we need to think about the fact that John's use of the third day here probably points to the resurrection. But it does so in a way that isn't just focusing on the resurrection, it's focusing on everything that leads up to that point. And though I read from the NIV and it didn't use the word hour, it uses the word my time. The Greek says hour. Jesus was saying his hour had not come. And he was pointing to the fact that when he did his first miracle, when the first sign was performed, the clock started to count down to the crucifixion. The hour had not begun, but it would at that moment. Well, all of those things are true, and we need to understand them before we begin to look at this passage. I don't want to focus on any of those, but rather, I want us to look at what we can learn about living the Christian life from this passage and how we are to live in an expectant relationship with Christ. We're going to begin with Jesus' mother and then move to the servants and finally to the disciples. But one more thing before we move to Jesus' mother, and that is a question. Haven't we all had moments that are no more wine moments? The moments that the doctor gives you the diagnosis, and in that moment we think we have no more strength to go on. The news that says there is an economic downturn and there's questions if the retirement fund will last long enough or if the job will still be there. Someone close to us dies and we aren't sure that we can proceed, or someone we love makes a decision that affects us negatively and we think that there is no way to mend the damage that's been done in the relationship. And we have no more wine. And I know there are so many more situations that we could look at that would fit the situation, and we could say, we have no more wine. The good news is that Jesus brings life to the party. Jesus, I guess we might even say Jesus is the life of the party because he brings life all things. But when we look at our Christian relationship, it begins in this passage with Jesus' mother. There is no more wine, and Jesus' mother comes and she asks. We don't necessarily read it as a question. It may be more of a statement, especially the way it reads for us. It may actually be more like the statements a parent would make to their child. The lawn looks awful. The garbage is full. The kitchen sink has dirty dishes. Now, you don't say what you're getting at. The child knows. You say, the lawn looks awful, it needs mowed. The garbage is full, it needs taken out. Jesus' mother comes and she says to him, she asks him to do something because quite frankly, John speaks only of Jesus' mother. He doesn't name her. And the two times she shows up in the book of John, he just simply says Jesus' mother or his mother. But she shows up and she knows about the dire need of the situation. And we don't know why. We honestly don't know how it is that Mary came to the knowledge that the wine was gone. Maybe it was a member of Mary's extended family. Because, you look at the end of the book, the second time Jesus' mother shows up, it says that her sister was also at the cross. So Mary had extended family. She had in-laws. Maybe she had brothers. We don't know. Maybe it was some relation to Mary. Maybe she was just a good hostess and the groom and his family said, hey, we need somebody to help with this meal. Would you mind? And she said, sure. We don't know, but Mary was in somehow. She came to the understanding probably before a lot of other people knew. In fact, it doesn't even look like the master of the banquet yet knew that there was no more wine. But Mary did. And so she turns to Jesus and she makes a statement that is a question or a request. They have no more wine. Jesus, this situation is about to get out of control. And she asks a question. She doesn't make a demand. And that's important for us to remember. Mary asks Jesus to do something, but she does not make a demand. She rather makes her statement, makes her request. And then you read John and it's like she says something to Jesus and Jesus starts to respond. And before he has a chance to finish what he's saying, she's turning around and walking away. This is what I'm going to tell you. And okay, that's great. But she's gone. She's there. She's gone. She doesn't make anything more than a simple request. John doesn't teach us about prayer. John, Matthew and Luke, you read Matthew and Luke and you find that they teach us or tell us what Jesus taught his disciples to pray. Matthew, you get the famous Lord's Prayer. You know, our Father who art in heaven. The Lord's Prayer. Luke records a very similar prayer that Jesus said when his disciples asked, teach us how to pray. Jesus said, you pray in this manner. He never said, these are the words. He just said, this is how you pray. This is the way in which you pray. John doesn't do that. Instead, what John does is he shows us. He gives us this passage, which teaches us about a relationship with God and asking. And then at the end of his gospel, he gives us a great prayer of Jesus prayed on behalf of the disciples and on you and me, on behalf of you and me. But John, he begins, and here his mother, we learn about the beginnings of prayer, and it begins by asking. It begins about making known to God the dire situations in our lives. And we all have those situations, and they're different for each one of us, and they come at different times in our lives, but we have those dire situations. And Mary teaches us that we need to let God know. It's not that God doesn't already know, but we need to turn our hearts and acknowledge to God that we are dependent, that we can't do things and we can't take care of things ourselves. And so we make known to God the direness of our situations. And unfortunately, if you're anything like me, there are two things that we do that we shouldn't. One is we say, well, the only thing I can do is pray. As if prayer is a minor thing. And the other one, it probably goes along with it, the only thing I have left to do is pray. As if when we've tried everything else and we've exhausted all of the possibilities, then we turn to God in prayer. But you see, we look at what John says, and evidently Mary, the very first thing she does is she turns to her son, who she believes can do something about the situation, and says, Jesus, they have no more wine. You see, the first thing and the most important thing we can do in those situations when our life seems to have no more wine is to turn to God and say, God, the situation is, well, from my point of view, it is very dire and impossible to deal with. There is nothing left for me to do. But Mary shows us one other thing about coming to God in prayer, and that is this. She makes a request, but she does not tell him what to do. You see, sometimes we get in this viewpoint where we think we can tell God what to do. God, my car is broken. Make it fall off a cliff and another one magically appear in front of me. I think I prayed that prayer once, and you know what? My car still stayed in front of me and never fell off the cliff, and I was disappointed. But Mary teaches us, Mary shows us that we don't have the right to demand of God what to do. We don't get to tell him. You know, we can tell him what we would like him to do. We can share with him what our desired outcome would be, but we do not get to tell God what to do. You know, my kids, when they were growing up, we would take them shopping because, you know, people frown on you leaving a two-year-old at home alone. Go figure. So we would take our kids shopping, and they learned very early that they could, in the store, they might be able to say, Mom or Dad, I would like, and they might have a chance, if the situation was right, to get whatever they were asking for. But they knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that if they threw a fit, they were going to get whispered in their ear, do we need to go to the bathroom and have a conversation? And you're not going to get what you're asking for. They knew that throwing a fit wouldn't get them the candy bar or the toy or whatever. You see, God's the same way. He wants us to tell him what we want, and he may give that to us, but we do not have the right to demand of God what it is we want. The second thing comes from the servants. The second thing we learn about our relationship with God and this intimate relationship, and that deals with obedience. It deals with obeying what God says. So Mary makes this request and she disappears from the scene. And Jesus, behind the scenes, where not a lot of people see what's happening, he turns to the servants. This is a wedding of somebody who is well-to-do. They have multiple servants, and they have these great expensive stone water jars that were used for ceremonies, ceremonial cleansing, and they have six of them. You know, this was lavish. But he turns to the servants, and he gives them a command. And at that moment, they have a choice. Do we obey and do what seems stupid? Really, it does. You read this, that sounds like a stupid command. Except for it's coming from Jesus, so we know it's not. But he says, take the stone water jars and fill them full of water. Now, the NIV helps us out. It says that these are 20 to 30 gallons apiece. Now, if you do the math on that, that's between 160 and 240 pounds of water, plus the weight of the stone jar. So Jesus isn't asking them to do something simple. He's asking them to do something that seems ridiculous and is difficult to do. And in that moment, they have a choice. And John tells us that they choose to obey. So they take these six stone water jars, wherever it is they need to take it. Generally, it would be somewhere a little ways away from where the party was going on, because they probably shared a well with the rest of the town. And so they had to carry these jars. They filled them with water, it says, to the brim. In other words, they filled it just as full as they could get it. And then they carried them back to the house. Or they made multiple trips with something else to fill up the jars a little bit at a time as they made treks back and forth between the well. And if that wasn't bad enough, then Jesus tells them to do something else that seemed even more dangerous and more crazy. He said, okay, now dip some of that out and take it to the headmaster of the wedding. Now, we don't know for sure. Maybe this guy was another servant who just happened to be the highest up on the list of servants of the house. Or maybe he was somebody who they had brought in, kind of like we might bring in a caterer today, who was in charge of the wedding banquet. But either way, they take this water out of these jars and take it to the head waiter, and they give him water instead of wine. Somebody's going to be in trouble. And I don't think they wanted that, but yet John tells us that they did this crazy thing out of obedience. And so they took some of the wine or water and they gave it to the headmaster. You and me, we have to learn to be obedient. We come to these no more wine moments and we want the privilege of asking God to answer us or to deal with the situation. But the thing is we have to be obedient in what Jesus has told us to do already. And at minimum, it deals with being obedient to what he asks all of us to do collectively. To go and to make disciples. But sometimes it's more simply the things that he might ask you and I individually to do. This is what he says at one time to a group of his disciples and other followers. He says, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling the worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And Jesus is speaking there clearly about financial things, but if we read through the rest of the scriptures, you find that this is a truth everywhere. God is not going to bless your idols. God isn't going to bless the things that you worship above Him. He's not going to share His glory, Isaiah says, with another. God will not bless our idols. And so if we want to see God listen to our prayers and respond the ways that we might want Him to, this passage tells us, John tells us, that we need to be obedient. In fact, that's part of the message of the Gospel of John, is, well, believing, which is to hear and to understand and to believe and live. He wraps that whole concept up together. The final thing that I see in this passage that is important for you and me to live our relationship with God, and that is trust. The servants had to trust that what Jesus was telling them to do made sense somewhere, somehow, some way. And unfortunately, to my dismay, John doesn't tell us where their trust became reality. You know, when did the water turn to wine, John? Did it come at the moment they poured the water into the stone jars? Did it happen the minute that the servants began to dip water out of those jars to take it to the headmaster? Did it suddenly turn to wine just as the headmaster began to sip a little bit of that wine? We don't know. But somewhere in the midst of the trust of these servants, Jesus did what only Jesus could do. He turned water into wine. He sped up the process of water becoming wine, because somewhere in there it missed several steps of being taken up into the vine and being pushed into the grape, into the fruit, and being mixed with other sugars, and then being harvested and squished and fermentation taking place. We missed all those steps. We just go from water to wine. Jesus is good at that. You know, dead people come back to life. He gives life where life isn't supposed to be for a long time. He brings water and turns it into wine. All we know is that somewhere in the midst of this transactional process, the water becomes wine. There's also trust on the part of the disciples. John says that they saw the sign and they believed. Now, we read what John writes through the rest of the gospel, that this isn't just a sudden miraculous revelation that they get it, and for the rest of his ministry they know 100% that Jesus is the Messiah and that they can trust him no matter what. Part of what they believe is simply that Jesus is going to do greater signs than the one he told Nathanael that he would see. You know, Jesus, in a passage we didn't look at, we kind of skipped over at the end of chapter 1, Jesus sees Nathanael underneath of a fig tree, and then he calls him, and Jesus said, "Oh, I knew you before now. I saw you sitting under the fig tree." Nathanael is astonished, and Jesus said, "Oh, you believe? You're going to see even greater things than this." This is one of those greater things that John says they saw, and they believed. And eventually, John will look back and he will learn that they can trust what Jesus had said. You and me, it means that we need to believe that God is going to do what is best. You see, Jesus didn't... Sorry, I bumped the button. Playing with my toys and they see the blank screen and I told them, that's your cue. Jesus, you and I need to trust God because Jesus didn't just produce some wine. He didn't just produce cheap wine. He produced a huge quantity, a large amount of the best wine. And his timing is not our timing. Jesus didn't immediately, when Mary was still standing there, say, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to turn some water into wine. Okay, here we go. Break, and everything happened. Jesus, in his own time, because he is controlling things, he will work things out in his time and not ours. And it's the same way. We don't know when those things will happen. For the servants, it happened in their obedience and their trust. For the disciples, it happened in their obedience and their trust. And after the resurrection, they began to put everything together. For you and for me, maybe God is going to work things out now the way we would like him to. And he may do it quickly. Or he may say, you know what? You need to hold on and wait. And we may have to wait until the other side of death before we begin to experience the promise that God will work. But the question is can we trust him? You see, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, now it's time. Matthew, Mark, and Luke talk about Jesus performing miracles. But John instead chooses to use the word signs. Signs that point to something beyond themselves, because he says that these help us to see that what Jesus says about himself and the ways that he shows us we are to live in relationship to God are trustworthy and bring life. So more than the sign, we are to see what the sign teaches. And while John tells us about turning water into wine, he's teaching us that we can trust God to give us the best, even when we don't understand what that is. Let's stand together and continue our time of worship this morning.